Welcome to the latest building podcast. I'm Jamie Harris, Buildings Digital Editor. Coming up in this episode.
It's apparent that everybody should have known months and months before that what was going on.
Already a year behind schedule, why is the Crossrail project causing so many problems? Also on today's episode.
That's what we need at the moment. We don't have any drivers. We don't have anybody looking over people's shoulders.
Taming the industry's out-of-control practices could benefit all levels of the supply chain. But who can make that happen? And finally,
what's going to be the difference here? Where are the teeth? Where are the powers in order to ensure that whatever the Commission or Andy Bromwreski says or does actually has an impact on the ground in the way we design?
Andy Bromwreski's appointment as the government's head of architecture comes at a time when the government is focusing on beauty in the built environment. But can this approach make a difference? Stick around. Crossrail is costing around £30 million a week as it struggles to reach completion and is £2 billion over budget. It's a year behind schedule and has no apparent end in sight. What has really happened at London's mega project, and what does it mean for UK construction? Joining Buildings editor Chloe McCulloch is Buildings correspondent Jordan Marshall.
So the background to the Crossrail story, we know it's late. We now know it's costing 30 million a week and there are still, I think, 6,000 workers on site. Today's story, complex technical work on the stations is not even half finished. So it feels like we're getting this kind of drip effect of bad news emerging on Crossrail. The extent of the work that still needs to be done is quite remarkable given that up until last summer, everyone thought it was going to be delivered in December 2018. So we've just done quite a detailed feature in the magazine this week looking at kind of what went wrong and why and who should have known what when, really. And I think there's been a bit of a political sideshow with this row between London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, and Sir Terry Morgan, the previous chair at Crossrail, you know, basically arguing over did the mayor know in July as opposed to August, whereas actually it's apparent that everybody should have known months and months before that what was going on. People on the ground, people actually building it at the coalface, knew, and there were, you know, reports out there flagging that things were not going to be delivered on time. How is this project being run fundamentally? What is the internal communication like between the people on the ground and the senior management? I don't know what you feel, Jordan.
Yeah, I think the review that got published recently that the DfT and the TfL, the sort of co-sponsors of the project, had commissioned, which sort of said showed how they'd, because the project was supposed to be winding down, well, obviously it wasn't actually winding down, they'd stopped doing risk management and stopped all these committees. And I think that's sort of symbolic of how the project was going. They weren't putting proper controls in place. And
so that's the KPMG report,
yes,
isn't it? Where they kind of, they were looking into kind of how could we got to this stage. And it is quite alarming, really.
Yeah, and talking to people in the private sector, they put it out there that, you know, if they had been working on a job with even a fraction of the value of this scheme, and suddenly they're like, oh, actually, it's not going to be open for at least another year, and then, oh, we don't know when it's going to open at all, there's no way they'd still have a job. And while Terry Morgan's gone, he can't be the only one who should have known what was going on. There must have been other people who should have also known what was going on. And while there's been a bit of a rejig of the management at Crossrail in general, I mean, there's been nothing said about any of the other former senior management. They've all sort of got up and unscathed, so it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and I do feel that the new guy at the top, Mark Wilde, he's set in motion a big review as to the work done to date and the work still to be done, and he's, I guess, quite rightly, given what's happened before, being very cautious about giving a new opening date until that work is done. You can understand why. You know, they don't want to put themselves on the line again and miss it again. They want to be really realistic this time and not put undue pressure, because it's, you know, it's a project that's under massive scrutiny.
Yeah, so I think that he really is reviewing it with a fine tooth comb, the new management team. He's brought in a lot of people that he's worked with, because he's from the London Underground, so he's brought in people that he's worked with there to help go through it all. And, you know, the latest revelation that they haven't got 50% of the, you know, installation of systems done at the stations, when it was supposed to already be open and running. That's quite alarming that there's still that much work to do at the stations.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the cash is going as well. A lot of the £30 million a week is going into finishing the stations, because that's where they've got, like, you know, the tier ones still working, which is crazy.
Yeah.
And so in this letter that he wrote to Caroline Pidgeon, who's the head of the Transport Committee at the London Assembly, he's now providing monthly updates to the London Assembly. He was saying that part of their new key strategy for getting it done is going to be having these tier one substantial demobilisation dates, where they've got key dates, they're trying to get people off to get down that weekly spend. And I think he said there's 22 dates and they've hit 11 of them so far. So there's still half of these tier one substantial demobilisation dates to go.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what we don't want to give the impression that, you know, we're undermining the scale of the task. It's huge. Crossrail badges itself as, I think, the biggest construction project in Europe at the moment. And it's, I think, one of the biggest infrastructure projects the UK has ever undertaken. So, you know, David Higgins has said to us when we were reporting on this to expect a project of that size and complexity to hit a deadline that was set for it back in 2007. It's a very small window to expect success, you know, to judge its success just on that. I take that point, and I think that is valid. And, you know, there's this amazing documentary going out on BBC at the moment. I think it's a third series looking at Crossrail. I caught a bit of it last night. And they were, like, leveraging in the glass roof. I think it was at Paddington Station. And it was amazing just seeing those glass, you know, realising, you know, that's just one tiny aspect of this huge project. And the skill involved and the dedication and passion of the people on the project, it's like you can't deny that. But I think the baffling bit when you're kind of reporting on this story is that, you know, you've got all of that brilliant work going on, and then you just don't seem to have the internal lines of communication where the team seems to be, you know, there's no joining up of the dots, or there hasn't been in the past. And I guess that's what Mark Wilde is going to be really on top of now. The communication is extremely clear. Reporting lines are really clear.
I suppose on that point, it's also quite interesting that when Mark Wilde addressed the TfL board a couple of weeks ago, he was sort of saying morale at Crossrail had sort of fallen off a cliff among staff. You can understand why. It's something they've been super passionate about for over a decade.
Yeah.
And it's just getting railed on. Even he said it's fair enough, like, there are issues and it's a big project with a lot of public spend, so there's got to be scrutiny on it. But it's potentially problematic if that is then causing issues within the company of getting the people who need to be motivated to finish it to finish it.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want your staff at a really critical time to be demotivated when you know that the project is going to be amazing once it opens. I mean, David Higgins made this point in our piece. Once it opens, the journeying public in London is probably going to forget that it's over a year late. Actually, when the public is, you know, when their journey times or their quality of their journey is transformed, they'll love this project. And when we see the stations in operation, it will be amazing. And actually, as Londoners, we're really spoiled, aren't we, that there are so many parts of the country that would love to have that kind of money spent on their infrastructure. It's to balance it, isn't it? It's going to be an amazing project, but at the same time, they've got to come clean about the extent of the issues that they've got. And I think they are.
Yeah, they are. So I think the bigger problem is perhaps they don't know the extent of the issues they've got. And so they've got to take the time to find out. And that is baffling, that you don't know even though what the problems are, essentially.
And you were telling me, Jordan, that you've actually been on one of the trains, the one from the testing, the one from Shenfield down to Liverpool Street, is that right?
Yeah, they're great, they're really comfy.
Yeah, so you were explaining to me there's these different stages that they were supposed to be testing, and that's all kind of now beyond what they planned, isn't it?
Yeah, so essentially stage one was getting those trains running from Shenfield to Liverpool Street, which is all fine and is happening. And then stage two was meant to have them running through the Heathrow tunnels and into Paddington. And Mark Wilde, talking to the London Assembly, I think in December, said that they never, part of the reason for the time crunch in stage three, which is the central section, which was meant to open in December, was the fact they spent so much time trying to get the signalling and stuff right, getting them into the Heathrow tunnels, which they still haven't done. They're still not running through. They're running into Paddington, but not as far out as Heathrow. So then stage three was meant to open last December, which was Liverpool Street through to Paddington. And that obviously hasn't happened. And then the remaining stages, which was first running the trains from Shenfield through to Paddington, I think that was meant to happen around the middle of this year, around August. And then stage five, which was having it running the whole way through, were all meant to happen by the end of the year. So there's, I can't see any way that is possibly going to happen.
Yeah.
So I guess the biggest question is how much of a delay we'll have on the overall scheme. Like, everyone's so invested in this middle scheme because that's a bit that runs through central London.
Yeah. But to get that whole through east to west service.
Yeah. And if they still can't get the trains into the tunnels at Heathrow, it's going to be interesting when eventually they do get bits open. Is it going to be delivering what it was originally supposed to be delivering?
Yeah.
Eventually it will.
And I think that's the aspect of the delay that our feature tries to hone in on. It's like, what exactly was the cause? And there is no one cause. It's all very interrelated and integrated. So you've got the signalling system. It's not just that alone. You've got the delays to the trains themselves. It's not just that alone. And then you've got the delays to the civils work and the fit out of the stations. It's such a complex project that to expect one aspect to be the issue, it's not going to be solved that quickly, is it?
No.
You can read more on what's gone wrong at Crossrail and why, as well as keeping up to date with the latest developments at building.co.uk/crossrail. Still to come on this episode, we look at the government's appointment of a new head of architecture. But first, most sectors in the economy have at least one, if not several, regulatory bodies. With construction seemingly unable to put its own house in order, should it have a national regulator of its own? Speaking to Buildings correspondent Will Ng is Rudy Klein, Chief Executive of the SEC Group.
Why do you think the industry needs a regulation authority?
Well, most other industry sectors have regulatory bodies, gas, water, and so on. And the remit of some of these bodies is to ensure that the industry that they regulate is properly run, best practice is achieved, bad practice is rooted out. That's the idea. And we need something similar in construction to try and achieve the same, I believe.
And what should it look like? And what problems should it go about trying to tackle?
Well, I think the authority, I think it should be a statutory authority. I think it should be properly resourced in order to do its job. And there are possibly three elements to its remit, which I think are important. I think the first thing, it should be an improvement body, so that it drives improvement in procurement and delivering construction. Secondly, it should be a good practice body, so that it challenges bad practice, promotes and achieves good practice in the industry. And finally, and this is possibly an optional third, that it provides perhaps advice, support for clients who are trying to procure construction and don't really know what's the best angle to pursue, what's the best route to pursue, and so this authority would help clients to find a way forward to ensure they get efficient and effective outcomes.
You have obviously championed fairer and campaign for fairer payment practices. Is it your view? I know you've talked about the regulatory authority having some kind of adjudication role. So is it your role? Is it your belief that it should play that role, or is actually it more important to sort out procurement and then everything else would follow?
Well, I think there are four priorities. Well, I think those four priorities, funny enough, start off with a P. And the first priority is procurement, because traditional procurement, much where what we've been about for years and years and years, isn't working. It's wasteful. It's, when I say wasteful, there's a lot of process waste involved. For example, we waste a lot of money trying to make designs work in practice, and that's because of poor procurement decisions right at the start. So procurement would be the first. I think the second is payments, another P. We need to obviously resolve that, because that's the biggest inhibitor of growth and innovation in the industry. The third thing is, again, another P, professionalism. And what I mean by professionalism is that we need to upgrade the industry's technical competence and capability. We've seen with various reports, for example, on Edinburgh Schools debacle and on Grenfell, that we need to up our standards, our technical standards in the industry. So professionals would be the third, and the final one would be policing, another P. In other words, we need to police our regulations properly to make sure that people are doing what they should be doing. One of the problems I think we have today is that you have a lot of firms who do the right thing, but then they are competing with those who don't seem to bother with complying with the relevant regulations. So effective policing is what's required. So to me, those are the four priorities, and so it just so happens that they all start off with P as well.
I think some people would say, in fact, some sort of contractors have said to me, that if you sorted out procurement and if you could get their margins right and their risk profile right and their business model right, if you could sort out procurement, then the cash flowing down through the supply chain would happen properly, and actually you wouldn't get the kind of level of financial disagreements which are present now.
Over the longer term, that will no doubt be the outcome. I think that's absolutely right. Lump sum, lowest price contracting is still very much with us across the board. And we have seen that pretty much condemned in all the various reports that have come out in construction in the last couple of years. There were reports before that saying the same thing. We keep on condemning this practice of lump sum lowest price contracting, but we never seem to get rid of it. It is a long term, it will be a long term effort, but in the meantime, of course, that we can't justify not paying people who provide most of the added value. That just cannot be, that's not sustainable. So we have to act now on payment as well to ensure that people in the supply chain where 85-90% of added value is delivered, we need to make sure that they are paid. So that is just as important.
And how can you speak a bit more about what you think the regulator could look like? Because I think, as you would agree, fragmentation is a real problem in the industry. The water and utility regulators or regulatory authorities work very well, but they have much fewer companies to focus on. Do you think that would be a problem?
Well, I think the fragmentation of the industry, well, you're quite right. It's quite acute compared to most other sectors, which I think probably makes it even more necessary that we have some oversight of the industry, given that the degree of fragmentation. So a regulator probably is much more necessary for construction than perhaps it is for some other sectors. But when I say, again, I just need to emphasize, when I say regulator, what I'm also doing here is drawing on not just the experiences of regulation in some of the other sectors, the statutory regulation in other sectors, but I'm also drawing on some other experiences. For example, in Canada, you have somebody called the Federal Ombudsman, Procurement Ombudsman in Canada. The Ombudsman in Canada is responsible for challenging bad practice in Canadian federal procurement. So there is a again a model there to pick out and possibly to use. I think also we have something in Singapore called the Building Construction Authority, which drives improvement in Singaporean construction and has been very successful in doing that over 20 years. So there's another model. It's just what I'm trying to do is to draw on the models that we've got, like sectoral regulation that we have in the UK, a lot of which I'd say is to do with improving standards and practices in the sectors they regulate. But then, of course, we've got the Singaporean model, which is about improvements, improving the industry, getting the industry to innovate. That's what we lack. We always talk about innovation. We never quite got the critical mass of innovation we really need. And then, of course, we've got the Federal Procurement Ombudsman, who actually promotes good practice in federal procurement in Canada, but also takes complaints from firms who have been badly treated in the federal procurement process, and takes up those complaints and deals with them. So all I'm doing really here is to look at the models around there, the regulatory type of models, and pull them together a bit to try and see what we can do here as far as having an authority here that will help drive the industry forward. That's what we need at the moment. We don't have any drivers. We don't have anybody looking over people's shoulders. We don't have anybody encouraging or trying to change what we do. And that is what we desperately need now.
You can read more on contractor regulation at building.co.uk/regulation. And finally, last week the government appointed Andy von Bradsky as its new head of architecture. The £60,000 post was created as part of ministers' focus on beauty in the built environment. The role was announced in the same week that a number of commissioners were appointed to Housing Secretary James Brokenshire's controversial Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission. Can this approach from government make a difference? Joining Elizabeth Hopkirk, Assistant Editor at Building's sister title Building Design, is Ike EJ, Building's Architectural Correspondent.
Well, last week was a big week in the world of architecture. We had the announcement of two things that we've been waiting for a long time. Probably the most significant was the announcement of Andy von Bradsky as head of architecture by the government. And we also found out finally who is going to be on Roger Scruton's Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission. Ike, what did you make of those appointments?
On the face of it, I think they're two good things. Andy von Bradsky is essentially, I suppose, given a formal title, the government chief architect. It sounds an unusual, potentially even anachronistic title to us today, but in a way it's a return to the past. We used to have tons of chief architects, not just in the government, in local councils across the country, and they were responsible for coordinating architecture, protecting design, stakeholder engagement, etc. So I don't think it's a bad thing to have a government representative, if you like, formalising that position within one person. And in terms of the Beauty Commission has come in for quite a great deal of scrutiny and some criticism.
Like we did there.
No pun intended. Criticism as well. And I mean, I suppose I can see it from both ways. On one level, nobody's going to argue. I suppose their mandate is, they're called the Beauty Commission. They're there to raise the quality of design. Nobody's really going to argue with that. But the criticism has come from the fact that, I mean, architecture is deeply tribalistic. Many people think this is just a kind of covert cover to get kind of traditional design or kind of stylistic mandate and getting that enshrined within government. That's a criticism of it. But at its core, both things are a recognition from government of the need to maybe have a more formal process in which to guide good design.
I think one of the problems is that there's no architects on the Scruton Commission. There's architects advising. We've got Sunan Prasad, the former yes. Reader President.
Yes.
Paul Monahan of Sterling Prize winning AHMM.
Yes. And that's a fair point. Yeah, you can see. You can certainly see it from the architectural position of being aggrieved. Obviously, it's architects who are going to be, maybe not primarily responsible, there'll be a great deal of the responsibility in terms of improving the urban environment falls to architects. So you would maybe expect them to be represented in the panel. But playing devil's advocate, architects aren't end users, and architects shouldn't be building for themselves. We build for the end user, we build for people. So it's no bad thing that people in the form of non-architects are maybe represented on the commission as well. And because architects should be so used to working with people in terms of stakeholder engagement, in terms of public consultation, there should then presumably be no problem with architects working with non-architects in order to improve the built environment.
One of the key questions is anything going to come of this commission? And Roger Scruton last week that he was unsure whether ministers would actually take his recommendations and run with them, which is curious in one sense because these two appointments came within,
they were successive
days.
Yeah.
Yes, and one of the jobs of Andy von Bradsky, it's a wide-ranging role, but one of his jobs is to help the government to interpret the recommendations of the Scruton Commission and to see how to implement them. So for Scruton to say that he's not confident that he's essentially got ministerial backing seems odd when Kit Malthouse and James Brackenshire are the people at the Ministry of Housing driving this whole sort of debate about beauty.
Well, I think you've touched on, Elizabeth, the key area in which both appointments are open to criticism, possibly. Not in terms of the kind of motivation behind having the appointment, but the actual potential for them to make any difference whatsoever. And, being cynical, I think the potential is actually quite limited. Neither Andy von Bradsky's role or the Beauty Commission is going to have any quantifiable statutory teeth. There's not going to be any kind of repetition of the planning process whereby, as well as getting planning permission, you need to get the sign-off of the Beauty Commission, as it were, or the chief architect. It's going to be just the way we love to do things in Britain, which is vague and imprecise. There's going to be no kind of clear, definitive statutory process whereby these two institutions or people will have a direct impact on planning policy or in the way we design. What's going to be the difference here? Where are the teeth? Where are the powers? Where are the legislative levers or devices in order to ensure that whatever the commission or Andy von Bradsky says or does actually has an impact on the ground in the way we design and in the look of the built environment? And I think there is a disconnect there. And we do have form for this because we've had CABE before.
Mm.
And CABE was around for a while. CABE also attracted its controversies. But one of the problems with CABE is that it became perceived as a kind of elitist echo chamber or kind of talking shop where people made worthy pronouncements about what good design is, but you didn't have to take those pronouncements on board. CABE could be scathing in their reviews, but it didn't really matter. They weren't a kind of official statutory part of the planning process. And as far as I can see, those kind of negations haven't been addressed with either of the appointments last week.
No, I think you're absolutely right. At the sort of heart of this whole beauty thing, if we're going to design quality housing, it's not about the style at all. It's about how well it's built and procured.
Absolutely,
and designed into the neighbourhoods that it's built in. And that is not Roger Scruton. I find it hard to imagine how he's going to solve that issue. You need to tackle things like, you know, our flawed procurement system.
Exactly. There's lots of things which are beyond his remit, which will still affect whether buildings are beautiful or not.
And those were addressed to some extent by Oliver Letwin and Nick Rainsfield.
Yeah.
And it feels like this work has already been done.
Kind of done, yeah.
Government's just
exactly.
ignoring the results.
Yeah.
And sets up things that probably sound good to the public. But
what difference do they make?
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And often these things aren't, it's not rocket science. I mean, at the end of the day, beauty to a degree is a pejorative term, but even if you take beauty outside of it, In terms of good urban design, in terms of public realm, in terms of street level activity, in terms of a vibrant urban design, these things are kind of like known now. We kind of know what to do. Why don't we just go and do it rather than setting up another commission or committee with no teeth in order to advise people to do what they kind of know what they should be doing anyway?
Yeah. One of the people I think who's doing really interesting work at the moment is Sadie Morgan, DRMM, but in her role on the National Infrastructure Commission and on the HS2 design panel. And they're now with the National Infrastructure Commission this week has put out some job ads for people like architects to join a design panel for them. And her, what she's attempting to do sort of inside government or in sort of quasi-government is to convince clients and ministers that good design doesn't equal loads of pound signs. I think that's often what clients are afraid of. They think an architect's going to come up with some kind of castle in the sky.
Exactly. Yeah.
What she's trying to show them is that actually good design saves money because you're solving problems long before they have been built and arise.
Yeah. And you're embedding value, which is what this language developers can speak, but design is as much related to value as balance sheets or budgets. It can be quantified in those terms. And I agree, I think it's good. It's interesting, this infrastructure commission, essentially, as far as I can see, it's kind of doing the same thing that the Beauty Commission is. But it's interesting, this kind of, I mean, I think words are important. I was actually surprised we went with the word beauty. Beauty can be a controversial term for modern architects. It wouldn't have been so much for architects in the past, but beauty's not necessarily been a kind of a goal, as it were. People say, oh, it's subjective. Does it matter if a building's beautiful, if it's functional, if it meets a brief, etc.? But here we have the Beauty Commission elevating it and saying this is important. But you can just about get away with it in housing, which is also another point. The Beauty Commission's work is limited to housing. But it's interesting that the Infrastructure Commission, the word beauty is nowhere to be found, but essentially it's doing the same thing. It's still about good quality design and how you achieve that. So as far as I can see, they're two sides of the same coin, really. It's not a bad ambition to have. We should be careful not to be too defeatist about this. There's nothing wrong with trying to make things look beautiful or aesthetically pleasing. But I completely appreciate it, Elizabeth. It's going to be a very difficult thing to do.
That's all we've got time for on this episode. Please do let us know what you think of these podcasts by leaving a review on iTunes or emailing us at building@building.co.uk. And you can listen back to our previous episodes on our website or on your preferred podcast app. You can read the latest news, analysis and feature content on the topics discussed today at building.co.uk, where you can find more information about joining our community as a subscriber. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jamie Harris. We'll see you next time.